Suddenly, I was reminded of the good Monsieur Garrick, a competent farmer from the south of France, from whom I learned the art of cultivating and tending a vineyard in the years 1939 to 1941. He was one of the survivors of the famous and bloody Battle of Verdun, being one of the most bloody battles in the history of warfare, in which he had been seriously wounded. A burst of machine gun fire had destroyed his stomach and part of his intestines, and from then on he lived, ate and digested thanks to a goat stomach that had been grafted onto him. And also by means of intestines pipes, he called them, laughing at his own shadow restored as miraculously as the rest of his shattered organs. And I asked myself, could this have made good Monsieur Garrick less human than another person with his original organs intact? So, I asked myself, why couldn't it be possible for these beings to carry part of their organism in non-perishable matter out to have discovered ointments, fats or any other type of natural protection, capable of preventing the deterioration of matter or ensuring its periodic regeneration? And why wouldn't they have reached such a level of knowledge that they were capable of preventing the survival and proliferation of the cells that destroy the human organism? During the time that this incomparable and impressive silence lasted, I could not say how many questions ran through my mind. Because I was still determined to find the one that would somehow put them between a rock and a hard place. I needed answers that would not awaken new mysteries in me. I did not yet realize that the prolongations of the mysteries that I was facing were not the result of their answers but of my insufficient capacity for understanding and assimilation. Of our deformed and deficient way of asking questions. I kept repeating all this to myself as I pondered, how is it possible that no one, no group of inhabitants of the earth, ever as far as I know had ever thought that the only great victory that the human race could achieve was precisely that, to conquer death? How was it possible that the earthlings who did not profess any religion, nor belong to any sect including, naturally, the great secular thinkers had simply accepted the irreversibility of death, that fatality of an eminently religious nature? How have they not realized that the other successes are nothing more than Pyrrhic victories? Yes, I know that I can be told that man is made of perishable matter and that a long rosary of scientific or pseudo-scientific formulas could be recited before me to prove to me that pursuing that goal, enjoying infinite life, is something that is beyond human possibilities. However, these pages could also contain the repeated echoes, reflected in scientific journals, books, of countless blind attempts made by specialists in all kinds of research, not to mention the discoveries made by pure chance. But, in reality, that was not exactly where I was going. A utopia every day, in reality, one was thinking first of all about another aspect of the question. I was cherishing the incredible perspectives that would be offered to us if we had made a 180-degree turn in the meaning of our life. He told me, if someone had even sketched out this utopia as achievable, even if its scope were thousands or millions of years away, it doesn't matter, and had managed to focus around it all the resources that nature offers us and those that human beings are capable of creating, it is unquestionable that the earthlings would have been much less obsessed and mortified by the idea of an inevitable and perhaps imminent end, and for that reason, I think, perhaps they would have yielded less to the temptation of practicing this obsessive and sterilizing cult of death. In particular by organizing wars or letting millions of people perish from hunger or as victims of all kinds of epidemics. And let's not forget that the wars that have caused the most victims in the world have been the so-called religious ones. Banish wars and definitively suspend this incessant and cruel holocaust of other people's lives, unleashed periodically, as if such massacres could be, for warriors, the guarantee of a better or longer life of their own. Placing this utopia in the sights of human beings would have been like setting before them, in the mind and heart of men and women, the most ambitious of objectives, an inexhaustible thirst for life, and getting them to dedicate to it, to life, all their worries, their efforts and their know-how. By orienting themselves, on the contrary, towards the most intricate twists and turns of dehumanization despite, I repeat, the omnipotent presence of so many religious doctrines, which played at being a humanizing factor for the inhabitant of the Earth, with the prolongation of their life expectancy, on the one hand, and with the growing vital anguish on the other. The only thing they have achieved, to use the words of our admired Americo Castro, has been to prolong their mortifying living in the throes of death, which in the modern era has become their daily bread. And so, over time, man has replaced the essential part of his existence, living his life with ever-increasing fullness, with the banal, the frivolous, that is to say, everything that gives pleasures that are as superficial as they are fleeting. More clearly, man had to be offered this entertainment, cosmic on all sides, that of harmonizing his existence in the image of the countless and inexhaustible resources of the universe and trying to achieve immortality with his own hands. Suddenly the right side of the grove lit up. It was flooded with light. It was a real sea of light, in which, although white predominated, bands of pink and orange could also be seen. Although, for a moment, in the rays of light a multitude of colors difficult to define were mixed, so I headed towards the place from which that light seemed to be coming. Silence, a key to survival, but, let's see, apart from the therapies or organic modifications that may occur in your civilization, aren't there other reasons, let's say of a preventive and personal nature, that can help your bodies survive? As the voice took a while to answer me, I began to think that perhaps I had made a mistake by insisting on the subject, and I could not help but have a certain amount of skepticism in the tone of my question. But no, that was not it. Little by little I was realizing the importance of the silences that were interspersed in our dialogue. It would not take long for me to learn a few more things about the vital value of silence, as a key to survival. Of course there are. One of them, the main one, is that, from an early age, boys and girls know their body thoroughly and learn to take care of it. Taking care of their body means, always being attentive to its most peculiar manifestations and treating it as what it is, as our best companion. This thorough knowledge of oneself facilitates the better identification of others and, therefore, the most appropriate harmonization of our respective bodies and, through them, of our experiences. Therefore, by looking after the health of each one's body, we also look after the health of the community. Furthermore, no one can determine the optimum moment of his personality, that is, the moment of definitive fixation of what will be his body for immortality, as you would say, better than the individual himself. The voice was silent for a few minutes and then added, well, apart from other measures, such as not smoking, not drinking alcohol and not taking drugs, we have physical exercise, appropriate to personal aptitudes, but there is another very important factor, which is the observance of complete silence, cosmic silence I will call it from now on, which affects all phases of our existence. First of all, silence during regular rest. From very early on, we are taught, as we discover our body, to relax, in a word, to live and rest in harmony with the body and its environment. You would surely say to master one's own body. It is this complete possession of oneself, relaxation with naturalness, which gives us total rest, with incomparable tonic and sedative effects. Silence, intelligently applied, helps to better preserve all organs, particularly the visual and auditory organs, while clarifying our mind. For example, there are many moments in our life that we can live with our eyes closed, and others with our ears covered. Look at the extreme care that earthlings often devote to their machines, those in the workplace or those for personal use, such as cars, and compare it with the little or no interest with which you take care of your bodies. Don't you consider this to be an unforgivable contradiction? From the degree of indignation, cosmic indignation I will call it from now on, to give it a dimension in keeping with the magnitude of the outrage that provoked it, that suddenly took hold of me, I deduced that they were constantly stimulating my reflections and I, while I was amazed at having managed to amass in my mind so much data and memories, asked myself how I had not been able, before, long before, to detect so much lack of authenticity, since always, on Earth, around the existence of its inhabitants. There was not a single part of earthly life where the fictitious, the inauthentic, the duplicity, the deceit, the most ridiculous self-satisfaction did not appear, and most of the time predominantly, because the deceiver of today ends up being the deceived of tomorrow. In short, it was going to be very difficult for us to regain those identifying marks that the human being of the earth must have lost a long time ago. Without a doubt, to change my mood a bit and put a bit of joy into my body, the voice said to me, "Now pay attention, please." First full-color documentary. In a matter of seconds, a small screen emerged from the center of the table in front of me. The lighting of the room was dimmed, and from the front of my helmet came a kind of transparent, slightly smoked visor, which came down to the height of my chin. And the first color images appeared on the screen, having an indescribable range of cosmic colors. And the voice said, "We are on the planet Green Crystal, and we are witnessing the departure of three small ships that are going to explore your seas. They are piloted by boys and girls from the training centers. Each one of them has 50 passengers on board. They are going to spend a season at sea, to live with the fauna and flora of the great depths. There are minerals and vegetation of great importance for our research, and also colonies of certain aquatic species, trained to collaborate with us." So I interrupted, "That you have bases on Earth, is it true?"
"In a way, yes."
"How in a way?"
"Of course, because if remaining underwater for a month or two, or landing our ships on one of your high mountains or in unpopulated areas, if that is having bases, then we will have to answer yes, we have bases. But if that means living permanently among you, in certain places, as is the case with certain terrestrial powers, then no, it is not true that we have bases. Do you have them somewhere else, on an asteroid or on a planet close to Earth?"
"Yes, naturally, we have authentic space bases that move continuously or that are suspended in the air, according to our exploration programs. And they only serve as simple stopping points for you."
"Not at all. All our carrier ships are authentic laboratories, and our activity, although it may seem redundant, is based on perfecting the resources destined to strengthen our organisms and improve our life, as well as enriching our knowledge of the places where we should live. Thus, as we gain greater immunity, we can undertake space explorations of unknown worlds. Always with the same objective, to marvel at the incessant discoveries we make, because the universe, as we know, is infinite and generates wonders without ceasing, and the immense joy of finding more inhabited planets is not the least of these wonders. And, when you come across an inhabited planet, do you not have any problems?"
"Of course problems arise. The inevitable ones of any unexpected contact. And then those that derive from its integration into our community, and those that can arise on the fly, totally unpredictable. And have you never come across planets armed to the teeth, like Earth, whose leaders did not want to have relations with you?" The voice took some time to answer. "Yes, it has happened sometimes. But never with weapons as dangerous as those currently possessed by Earth."
"And when that happened, what did you do, if I may ask?"
"In that case, we have not deepened our contacts. We have remained, as we do with respect to you, waiting."
"So, it is possible that there are inhabited planets in the cosmos that are not integrated into your community?"
"Of course there are. Could they not be populated by those aggressive little green men who, apparently, are seen from time to time on Earth, and who also travel in flying saucers?"
"It is very possible, although we must point out that sometimes we have sent small ships, in service of exploration, with entirely automated crews. Or remote controlled, if you prefer, and in many cases their metallic attire was precisely greenish in color. And they are the ones who, apparently, have attacked Earthlings on occasion.
Well, our mechanical collaborators are programmed to defend themselves, but only if they are attacked, or to self-destruct if they are captured. They never attack first. We can assure you of that. But if your puppets show up like that, out of the blue, without warning, it is logical that my countrymen will be frightened, and that fear will make them do something stupid."
"Yes, it is natural, These are the minimum inconveniences of these unexpected contacts. So no one has endangered the peace of the cosmos like the leaders of the Earth? No, until now such a type of crisis was unknown to us. Well, but you, now that the danger is so evident, perhaps you could intervene before it was too late. For example, why not intercept, destroy or capture some of the ships manned by Earthlings? Or better yet, those that go without a crew. I say this because if there are no human victims, the impact would be less unfavorable among the Earthlings. The answer came quickly and sharply: we cannot do that. The universe belongs to everyone and, therefore, it is also yours. None of us would ever dare to commit the slightest aggression or violence against anyone without very powerful reasons for doing so. In case of self-defense, added. That's right, yes. And, even in such a case, we would do it with deep fear, because that would mean a regression for our community, a step back. In other words, we would fall into that cyclical, stupid and harmful game that you Earthlings practice, which is to resort to the destruction of life. And our computer coordinators would enter the dance, for the first time, with negative, destructive purposes, which is the opposite of what they have been built and programmed for. You don't mean to say that these gadgets also have sensitivity? No, not at all. What we want you to understand is that, in our world, people and machines form a harmonious whole and that this is the fruit of millennia of purely peaceful work. And that any strange phenomenon or event, and even more so if it were of such dimensions, as could be an intervention of ours in some part of the Earth, he could have said, against some nation, would break that harmony, which is the basis of our coexistence and our life. Do you understand? It is as if within a family, and we are using another unit of measurement here so that you can understand us better, which is accustomed to living in peace and harmony, suddenly, the father or the mother, or both at the same time, began to get into a bad mood, to shout and to utter threats. It would be of little use to explain that all that unrest was caused by some neighboring family. The reality would be, in any case, this, that the peace and harmony of that family, however exemplary the existence of its members, would be profoundly altered, disturbed. We do not know if this example is sufficiently clear. Yes. Naturally it is clear. For no apparent reason I remained silent, and so did they, as if waiting for the obligatory postscript. And this would come naturally. Well, all this means that you will never provoke a preventive war. Exactly. Neither preventive nor of any other kind. Let it be noted once again, I have always moved among peaceful people. I mean, especially when I was with libertarian friends or colleagues. We were people of peace by vocation and training. But I give my word that never, in such a short space of time, Earth time, of course, had I heard so many songs of peace sung as in the few hours I spent chatting with them, men and women, in their spaceship. When silence fell again, the color documentary came on again on the small screen. I saw how the small ships glided towards the depths of the sea, slowly and with their lights very dimmed. When they reached the mouth of what seemed to be a large underwater cave, while one of the ships remained on guard at the entrance, the other remained above, between two waters, on duty as a guard, they explained to me. The third ship entered the cave. With the same slowness as before and with a very subdued light beam. As I watched that magnificent underwater landscape pass before my eyes, the voice explained to me, "You must have noticed the slow pace of our ship and the poor light it uses to explore those depths." "Yes, that's true," I answered immediately. "Well, you should know that this is done to disturb the environment as little as possible and not frighten the fish. That way they don't run away, but continue living their normal life, accompanying us and facilitating our investigation. The same thing happens when we explore a forest. We must always respect the existence and, above all, the tranquility of the animal species. That way we are not feared and everything is easier. And not only the fauna, but we must also respect the flora. Do you understand?" I was embarrassed, that's the truth. because I couldn't help but think about the amount of gunfire that disturbs the peace of nature on Earth as soon as the bans are lifted. I thought I could also hear the crazed barking of the sniffer dogs, and the thousands of other noises, most of them gratuitous, that man spreads throughout the environment. Later, when I was on my way to Barcelona, among the many questions I thought I could have asked them, was to find out if they were vegetarians. And I thought again about the cosmic peace in danger, thanks to the work and grace of the Earthlings. It took me a little more than a minute to reach the edge of a meadow, which is where the light began, and from there I began to make out the silhouette of an enormous spaceship, about 50 to 75 meters wide. The light came from the top and the bottom of the ship. So I jumped from the path into the meadow and I was as if enchanted. While the two beams of light slowly went out, I heard a voice in correct Spanish, with a sing-song tone, somewhat musical, that said to me, "Do not be afraid, please come closer." I then approached the ship, whose base was now illuminated by a powerful white and pink light source, which seemed to be coming from an open door in its underbelly, from which a kind of ramp soon emerged. The harmonious order, in cosmic danger. "Does that mean," I asked, "that death would reappear in your spaces, if these dangers were to materialize?" "It is not so much the reappearance of physical death that worries us, because we can quickly stop that danger, but something much more serious, such as the disruption of cosmic life, so harmoniously interwoven, and the destruction, on a greater or lesser scale, of that universal order on which our experiences flourish and develop. Take as an example the respect for the tranquility of all kinds of fauna and flora, which we spoke to you about, and the silence that is so important in our lives. The mere sound of a bomb would greatly alter the cosmic environment. It is something that you can hardly understand, because you cannot yet grasp the full grandeur of our peace. In a meteoric vision they would parade before me, with images and sounds very much in keeping with them, that is to say, the thunderous noises invented by the Earthlings that pollute our life, day and night, capable of altering and disarranging the organisms of any living species, on this Earth of our times and on any inhabited planet. But the truth is that I did not know what to say. My mind, however hard I tried, could not conceive the disastrous results of such a monstrosity, that we were capable of endangering the foundations of such a marvelous spatial architecture. Indignation once again gnawed at my insides more strongly than ever, when I thought of what life on Earth could be like if human beings, for the sake of the common good, proposed it. I remembered, word for word, one of the most interesting and entertaining talks I heard about nature during my time as a student, between 1931 and 1936. I owe it to my natural history teacher at the Scientifè I Militant School, Don Alberto Carsi Lacasa, in the 1936-1937 course. He was also one of the main promoters and organizers of the CENU, Conseil de l'Escola Nova Unificada, and died in exile in the mid-1950s. In 1948, in France, when our old teacher and friend resumed his courses, but this time by correspondence, at his own risk and expense, with the new generations of young Spaniards in exile, he spoke to us again about nature, and about what our behavior towards it should be, with the same words as before. It is necessary to insist that this brief text be read and reread, the unmistakable work of the good Don Alberto, also an eminent geologist, a praiseworthy work that he shared with his brother Ricardo. A curious detail, the first was a complete atheist and the second a convinced Catholic. I had the opportunity to meet both of them and I confess that it would be very difficult for me to say which of the two was the better person. Both were goodness personified, that is the truth, perhaps because both sincerely believed in what they defended and, as I have said elsewhere, because they were of that breed of humans who preached by example. But let us return to Don Alberto's text. In it he speaks of nature as a source of life, and the word harmony is mentioned four times. He also speaks of naturalness and sexuality, of knowing one's body and of all that sum of attitudes and actions centered on the march towards universal harmony. Language, in short, identical to that used by the crew of the spaceship Light of the Cosmos. Let me be clear, therefore, once again, that long before the extraterrestrials gave evidence of their existence and through a thousand different channels sent us their messages and communications of a fraternal and paternal tone, sometimes, on this Earth of ours, there was already a species of Earthlings who had, to put it in newly coined words, in our long conversation and their prolonged silences, and were infused with cosmic essence. An essence that, by all means at their disposal, they tried to infuse into their fellow men. Such an attempt would lead to the firing squad, blessed by Spanish Catholicism, the firing squad, not the executed, in Montjuic, in 1909, among others, the founder of the modern school, Francisco Ferragardia. Now the full-color documentary was showing me the return of the sea-exploring ships to one of the planets. There were many people in the landing area and I saw large tables of all kinds of fruit, very brightly colored. They were men and women of smaller size than my companions. Some were light-skinned, like them, others somewhat olive-skinned and some dark-skinned. There were several groups singing and dancing, holding hands, in open circles, just as I have seen dancing in certain regions of Yugoslavia and Greece. I did not know where to look, in my eagerness to capture all the details. But as interesting as what I was seeing was, what amazed me most was seeing the faces of my four interlocutors. As I walked by, I saw the faces of my four interlocutors. As he lowered his visor, the vaporous halo began to move away and reveal their features, those of two men and two women. They seemed to have Nordic-type faces, especially those of the men. The beauty of their features reminded me at times of certain ancient Greek statues. The women had a flatter nose and a less white complexion. It was difficult to identify the skin shade, I suppose, because of the ambient light, which was generally very white, sometimes slightly interrupted by pink or bluish nuances. They soon realized my astonishment. "Did you think we were very different from you?" I didn't know what to answer, because in reality I, personally, had never really known what kind of morphology was usually attributed to extraterrestrials. I was completely unaware of the various being seen or contacting Earthlings. I continued to observe them. The two women looked like they were 25 to 30 years old, and the men were a bit older. One of them could be 40 to 45 years old and the other 30 to 35. Always measuring by our standards, of course. The voice added, "In our community there are groups that are different from us, but only in external appearance. The fact is that I continued to project my retrospectives mentally at an incredibly fast pace. And, naturally, I remembered my school years, before July 1936. And I saw our field trips take note, 3 half-days a week with the entire team of the Escuela Labor, about 80 boys and girls from 6 to 12 years old guided by our teachers, Germinal, who was the director when he was not yet 20 years old, and his three assistants, also, like him, student teachers, the three under 20 years old 13. For the first time I saw the person who was chatting with me through the translator smile. A device that, according to them, was capable of transmitting in all the languages of the Earth and in the thousands of dialects used in its 5 continents. One time, I was asked if I wanted to continue the conversation in Catalan, French or the Oc language. His words seemed to me watching him move his lips more like babbling, but the Spanish translation was still sing-song, musical, with a very pleasant sound that, at times, still rings in my ears. I asked what language they used among themselves and they answered that they used a conventional sign code, particularly when communicating at a distance. Something like Esperanto? I asked, without thinking too much. Well, yes, in part. We use language and signs indifferently. It all depends on the matter. Sometimes, as you could see in the documentary about the green crystal planet, we also converse with our hands, as your deaf mutes do with such harmonious elegance. Because silence, as we have already said, is very important for our sensorial balance and also for the environment. The truth is that I had not captured all the images of that reception party very well, always at the mercy, as I was, of the obsession to file as many impressions in my memory as possible. And I must have taken many of those signs words as demonstrations of joy.